You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2010, the 17th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in San Francisco, California, from February 16th through February 19th, 2010.
From drugs in development, let's move on to drugs that currently exist. What kind of research was presented here at CROI regarding recent efforts to improve existing treatment options for patients?
Probably the most important one was the eagerly awaited results of ACTG-5202. This may have been the most confusing presentation at CROI, not because the presenter did a bad job, but because, again, they were forced to combine a lot of data into a 10-minute period instead of breaking it up. But this was a study that looked at two things. It looked at Epsicom versus Truvada, and it looked at Sustiva versus boosted Reataz, and so since there were two comparisons, there's four arms. So you have Truvada, Sustiva, Truvada, Reataz, Epsicom, Sustiva, Epsicom, Reataz. So it's a complicated study design. And we had already heard in Mexico City in 2008 the results of this interim analysis where the DSMB recommended the patients with a viral load of above 100,000 be unblinded as to their nucleoside assignment because the Epsicom was underperforming. There was a higher rate of virologic failure in that group of patients with high viral loads, and it was suggested that they switch over to Truvada. So that's the last we heard, and nobody understood why that had happened, and we were all kind of waiting to see the final results. And as you could imagine, in any study comparing four different regimens with the size of this study, there's going to be a lot of different nuances. I think the bottom line for me is that this was probably, I think, the first clinical trial that showed that a boosted protease inhibitor could be as effective as Sustiva. So in terms of virologic efficacy, boosted Reataz and Sustiva were pretty much the same. And that was true whether you looked at Epsicom or Truvada. The other thing that I thought was interesting, I think most people assume that because Epsicom didn't do as well as Truvada in the high viral loads, that we would see some inkling of that in the lower viral loads, that we would say, well, maybe the differences weren't as big, but Epsicom would still not be as good as Truvada at low viral loads, and in fact, that really wasn't true. At the low viral loads, you couldn't see any sign of that earlier failure that we had seen at the high viral loads, making it still very puzzling of why we saw that in the earlier analysis. But there were some differences, mostly favoring Truvada, and that had to do with safety and tolerability. If you looked at the time it took before you got to a significant safety event, if you were taking Epsicom with Sustiva, you were more likely to develop one of those events than if you were taking Truvada Sustiva. Didn't seem to affect the ones who were on Reataz. There was also a shorter time to treatment modification if you were on Epsicom with either Sustiva or Reataz. Now, a lot of that was probably because of hypersensitivity. They weren't doing HLA B5701 screening in this study, so you could argue that that kind of a difference wouldn't apply today where we screen people and they don't develop hypersensitivity reactions. And then finally, there were greater lipid changes with Epsicom versus Truvada, and there were greater lipid changes with Sustiva. So if you were on Epsicom and Sustiva, it was kind of a double hit because you had the two drugs that caused the most lipid changes. On the other hand, the lipid changes that were seen were not affecting the cholesterol HDL ratio. So some would argue that even though they're differences, it's probably of marginal clinical significance. There's all sorts of other comparisons we could look at, but it gets pretty tricky. I guess one that I should mention, too, is that if you did fail on Sustiva, you were more likely to develop resistance than if you failed on Reataz. And that's not surprising. We saw that in 5142 when Sustiva was compared with Caletra. So lots of little nuances here, but I think there are at least some conclusions we can draw from this.
This is a dizzying number of different conclusions. Some of them are potentially conflicting. The adverse events on efavirenz versus atazanavir, the high viral load being worse for Epsicom than for Truvada, but not so much at lower viral load levels. For an everyday clinician, is this becoming a situation where, okay, we've got these four or five different regimens that could potentially work really well for first-line therapy? Do you need to literally go to a chalkboard and work out a chart where you're laying out, okay, so these are all the pluses of this regimen, these are all the minuses, and then weigh positives and negatives of many different regimens before you make a decision? Or can we somehow simplify this?
I think that's what we have guidelines for, and maybe I have a bias in the sense that I'm on the guidelines panel, but I think the guidelines panel does this job for you. They sort out the data and they come up with some recommendations that I think are quite reasonable. Obviously, the panel will need to go and look at 5202 and a number of the other studies presented at CROI to make sure that changes aren't required. But I actually think personally that the list is a pretty good list right now for preferred regimens and that the 5202 results support the current list. So the current list of preferred regimens is Truvada, plus either boosted Reataz, boosted Prezista, Isentris, or Sustiva, in which case it's a tripla. So those four regimens, I think, are the right ones to reach for, but they won't be the right ones for all patients, and that's where you go to the alternative list, which is also a good list of regimens.
It's actually maybe a point worth emphasizing that the word alternative can be, I think, potentially and maybe has been misconstrued by portions of the clinical community to mean, well, maybe you should avoid these drugs. But it seems like what you're saying is more, no, if the preferred drugs work really well, the alternative ones work really well too, but may not be the greatest ones to use because you've got better.
Well, yeah, I think the point that the guidelines make is very important. It says the alternative regimens may be preferred for some patients. So, for example, if you have a patient with kidney problems, then none of those preferred regimens may be the right choice, and an Epsicum-based regimen may be preferred for that patient. It doesn't mean you're using a bad regimen. It's just that it's kind of saying if all else is equal, you would pick a preferred regimen. If there's no reason not to pick a preferred regimen, you would pick one of them. But a pregnant woman should be on Kaletra, for example. Somebody with kidney disease should not be on tenofovir. So there's lots of reasons to go to the alternative list, and they're perfectly acceptable regimens. Most of them have shown good efficacy, and it's just an issue of maybe some tolerability differences or things like that.
So moral of the story, as the biased representative, study the guidelines.
Yes, absolutely. And I would say, too, that when you look at the guidelines, don't just look at the tables. People tend to think of the guidelines as a few tables that tell them what to do. But, boy, things are getting complex, and especially the when to start question and where they're in, within the guidelines panel, there are differences of opinion. And if you read the text, I think you really will learn a lot and get a better sense for the nuances and subtleties of what we're recommending.
That may or may not be becoming more clear as a result of research presented at this conference, which we'll get into shortly. In the meantime, let's move on to further discussion of currently approved drugs. There was new data presented here at CROI on darunavir.
Darunavir is already approved for both treatment-experienced and treatment-naive patients. It's now a preferred first-line PI at the dose of 800/100 once a day with ritonavir boosting based on the Artemis data. But the package insert, the FDA label, says that for treatment-experienced patients, you should use the original power study dose of 600/100 twice a day. And everybody, you know, I think has assumed that although the label says treatment experienced, what really matters is whether patients have PI resistance and perhaps specifically darunavir resistance. In my own practice, a patient may get the once-a-day regimen even though they're treatment experienced if I know that they don't have resistance to darunavir. This study set out to kind of prove that, presumably so they could get their label changed. And what they did was they took patients who had treatment experience but no darunavir resistance, and they randomized them. They randomized them to either the once or twice a day regimen. What they found was that the results were the same for the two arms. The problem with the study is that, in fact, most of these people had no PI resistance at all. That's kind of what happens these days when people fail PIs that are boosted. They tend not to have resistance. So, again, this study was really comparing PI-naive patients once a day versus twice a day, so it's no surprise that they would do just as well on once a day. But nevertheless, at the very least, it could lead to a change in the label to say that you would use this for patients with no PI resistance or patients with no darunavir resistance. That would help a little bit.
Is there anything that's particularly new here? I mean, presumably, even though it wasn't necessarily approved, I'm assuming at least some clinicians were already prescribing once daily.
I would hope so. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to go strictly by whether they're treatment experienced or not. And I understand that the FDA had to do it that way because that was the way that the Artemis study was set up. But from a scientific standpoint, what you care about is whether they're resistant to darunavir or not. For me, the interesting part of this study was really the lipid results. And there was a very significant difference favoring the once-a-day arm in LDL cholesterol and triglyceride elevations. So people on twice-a-day had quite a lot more, almost double the amount of lipid elevation. We've questioned whether the differences among PIs are due to the PI itself or to the amount of ritonavir or both. In this case, you can't be sure because one group is getting 1,200 milligrams of darunavir and the other is getting 800. But I think the more significant difference is that one group is getting 100 of ritonavir and the other is getting 200, and I suspect that that's what's really driving this difference, which I think supports the idea that we should be using 100 milligrams of ritonavir unless we have a good reason not to. And in a naive patient, there's almost never a reason not to use a regimen that includes only 100 milligrams of ritonavir.
There's no necessarily broader conclusions to reach here. This might just be a further indication that, there's no point in twice-daily dosing of darunavir?
Well, there is a point for treatment-experienced patients. Definitely for those with PI resistance, that's definitely the dose to use. But what I think it tells us is that at least these lipid changes suggest to me that the guidelines are correct in narrowing the list of preferred PIs to boosted atazanavir and once-a-day boosted darunavir. Because why would you use a regimen where you had to use 200 milligrams of ritonavir unless there was a good reason? Why not use the lowest possible dose of a drug that clearly elevates lipids?
From here, let's move into a topic that I suppose has been growing in its urgency over the past couple of years, or at least has received a large amount of renewed attention, the idea of latent HIV reservoirs and what happens when a person is on fully suppressive therapy over many years, but yet still appears to be developing potential complications, apparently related to HIV. There were a number of studies, I believe, presented at CROI that examined the idea of taking suppressive therapy and further intensifying it with another drug with the idea of maybe drawing out some of that latent HIV.
There's sort of two ideas around intensification. One is to try to improve CD4 response, and the other is to further suppress viral replication. So, for example, we had the ACTG study looking at maraviroc intensification in people who were suppressed on antiretroviral therapy but were having poor CD4 responses. And the hope was that because maraviroc had been shown to have what appeared to be kind of an independent effect on CD4 count, that this would improve things. But in fact, it was pretty much a negative study. While there were some people that seemed to benefit, but for the most part, there was no clinically significant gain in CD4 count. That leaves us really still not knowing what to do with patients who have poor CD4 responses. And although it's not much help to those patients, I would say that this further emphasizes the critical importance of starting people early, because then they won't get into that situation. The other type of intensification was with raltegravir, and there was a twofold rationale for this. One was, again, looking at CD4 increases. There had been a little hint of CD4 improvement with earlier raltegravir intensification studies. That was not seen with these. Again, this didn't seem to make much of a difference in CD4. The other idea was to see whether you could take people whose viral loads were under 50 but not under 1. In other words, they have some low-level viremia in that 0 to 50 range, and further suppress it. The idea there being maybe it's better to have a viral load of less than 1, maybe that would reduce inflammation and immune activation, but also because from a pathogenesis standpoint, it would tell us whether or not there is ongoing replication of HIV despite therapy or not, and that's a really important question. Most of these studies have not shown any change. You take a person whose viral load is, let's say, 20, and you give them raltegravir or other drugs, and in almost all of the studies, we've seen no difference. What that probably indicates is that there really isn't viral replication going on, that this low-level viremia that we see is probably not a function of replication, but a function of just a release of virus from reservoirs. And that's good news in the sense that we really are suppressing patient's viral replication with the therapy we have. But it perhaps also tells us that we're not going to be able to deal with eradicating reservoirs just with antivirals alone.
How long can reservoirs continue to release particles of HIV?
Probably as long as they exist. Now, I don't think that the release of these particles is a bad thing. It's not doing any harm. It's just a sign that these reservoirs exist. These aren't viruses that are going on and infecting new cells and replicating. The real issue is, how do we eradicate HIV from the reservoirs? Not so much how do we stop them from releasing virus.
As a whole, then, what does this tell us about the nature of latent infection and the power of intensification to really do anything of benefit?
I think it says that the way to deal with latent infection is not antiretrovirals, at least not the ones we have now. That we've already done the best we can do at suppressing virus. And that if we're going to eradicate HIV, or if we're going to try to achieve what Dr. Fauci calls functional cures, it's not going to be by giving more drugs. It's going to have to be by something that activates latent cells, wakes up the reservoir, or provides some sort of improved anti-HIV immunity. But we've done about as much as we can do in terms of viral suppression.
Well, that seems to be very much the line of thinking that Tony Fauci, who is the head of NIAID, which is a major funder of U.S. HIV research, he seems to be thinking in the same direction. I mean, he actually announced at this conference that NIAID was going to be focusing its efforts much more on issues related to prevention, particularly vaccine development and eradication, perhaps at the sacrifice of research that focuses on existing treatment.
You can see the bright side and the dark side. I mean, who knew that in 2010 we would hear that NIAID was going to really focus on eradicating or curing HIV? You know, for so long, the idea of eradication or cure was just kind of pie in the sky, and people didn't really talk about it seriously, and now they are, which is great. But I also think, who could predict that we would be really downplaying the role of treatment? The implication is, well, treatment's good enough now, and it's time to move on. Maybe that's correct in terms of having the greatest impact on the epidemic, but for people who have HIV, obviously treatment research is very, very important to them. So it's a good news, bad news sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a tough pill to swallow, pun exactly intended, for people who are living with HIV, particularly in light of, and we saw a lot of this at CROI as well, over the past couple years in particular, we have seen growing signs of people with HIV developing a range of complications, particularly ones that are cardiovascular disease, inflammation, bone disease, CNS issues, cancers, that they appear to develop them at an earlier age than people who are HIV uninfected. There was a good amount of research that was presented about all of these things at CROI, but the question is then, how much of that is going to actually continue?
That's a very concerning question. I think that's really what's hot right now, is trying to figure out whether this so-called premature aging, and I say so-called because I don't think it's necessarily a single phenomenon. It may be a collection of multiple phenomena going on at once. But I think the question is, to what degree do we prevent that with HIV therapy versus how much of that is going to happen regardless of therapy? And I think that's one of the big unanswered questions. There's no question that people do better if they're on therapy than if they're not. But do we completely eliminate the risks by putting people on therapy? And I think the answer we're beginning to see is no, that there are still things that happen even when you're treated. And we desperately need to continue to research those issues if we're going to begin to see these long-term complications over decades of therapy.
What did the research at CROI tell us that's new in those areas?
I'm very interested in the whole when to start question, and I'm a pretty big advocate of starting people early, even to the point of just starting everybody with HIV on therapy. And I think the data at CROI supported that concept for the most part. We saw a number of studies that looked at the issue of the CD4 count, including the nadir CD4, the lowest that you've had, and correlating it with the development of certain complications. So, for example, from the large CHARTER study, which is looking at neurologic complications of HIV, they found that your neuropsychological performance on specialized testing was a direct function of the lowest CD4 count that you've had. So if you started out with a low CD4 count, even if you're on therapy doing well now, you have a poorer neuropsychological performance than if you started with a higher CD4 count. Other smaller studies had shown that before, but I think that's of critical importance in saying that we really need to not be waiting for people to develop low CD4 counts before starting therapy. There was a group that looked at arterial stiffness as a measure of sort of a proxy for atherosclerosis, and again found that the nadir CD4 count was a risk for or was associated with arterial stiffness. So that the idea is that if you wait too long, you begin to develop coronary artery disease. And then we saw that nadir CD4 count was associated with a higher risk of fracture in the HOPS cohort. Everything just keeps telling me that we need to get away from this emphasis on immunosuppression, the old idea that, well, as long as you keep your CD4 above 200, you'll be fine, or you could change that to 350. I think what we're seeing is that HIV does bad things to you regardless of what your CD4 count is, and we may not see those differences right away, but I think over time these studies are telling us that it's not good to have viremia, and that we should be focusing as much on suppressing viral replication as we do on preventing immunosuppression.
We're just 3 months removed from the latest iteration of the USDHHS treatment guidelines for HIV-infected people, and that most recent update included an adjustment to the when-to-start recommendation. Although, in what may have been a first for the guidelines, they actually specifically state that the panel was pretty split over this issue. Does the research presented here at CROI, and maybe in general over the months since those guidelines came out, do they just add to the amount of evidence that may further sway members of the panel in the future to go more towards the, you know what, maybe we should start therapy above, not just above 350, but maybe even higher?
First, let me just spell out what the guidelines say now. Everybody agreed that you should start below 500. The split there was only about whether people felt that it was a strong or a moderate recommendation. It wasn't really a split. It was just a split on emphasis. Below 500 is where we recommend therapy overall. But then half the panel felt that we should recommend therapy above 500, in other words, at any CD4 count. And the other half of the panel didn't think that was wrong necessarily, but they just felt that it was more optional. So that was where the split was. But I interpret this to say that the guidelines now support treatment at any CD4 count, but just with a different sense of urgency based on where your CD4 is, so that if it's very high, then it's less urgent. The lower it gets, the more urgent it is. And I certainly think that the stuff presented at CROI only supports that. I can't say whether it will cause a change in guidelines. I think that most likely the when-to-start issue will take a rest for a little while before coming out with yet another revision so quickly. But I certainly think that the stuff we heard is supportive of what the guidelines panel came up with.
There were some other presentations at the conference, too, on life expectancy and mortality and how they relate to CD4 count also, no?
Yeah, there had been a nice study a while ago from the Aquitaine cohort in France that basically said that if you achieved a CD4 above 500 and you had an undetectable viral load and you maintained this for, you know, I think it was 5 or 6 years, your life expectancy was essentially going to be that of the HIV-negative French population. And I think that's a study that I cite a lot to my patients, because so many of these life expectancy things, they'll say, well, overall you can expect this many years of life lost if you have HIV. I don't find that very helpful to an individual patient, because it includes the data from people who don't take their meds, who have hepatitis C, all sorts of things. And if my patient isn't like that, then they can't really use those data to look at their own expectation. Whereas I think if you narrow it down, as the Aquitaine cohort did, to patients who are doing really well, I think that's very useful. So in CROI, we saw data from the Athena cohort, which is the cohort from the Netherlands, which modeled life expectancy for patients who were treatment naive and without AIDS 24 weeks after diagnosis. And again, they found that their life expectancy was around 53 years, which is essentially the same as uninfected controls in the Netherlands. The question then is, okay, they're going to have the French data and the Dutch data say that you can have the same life expectancy under the right circumstances. The question then is just, will your quality of life be the same? Or will you be plagued with complications of aging at a younger age than HIV-negative people, and that's, I think, where the real question lies.
So as a clinician, how do you talk to your patients about that kind of thing? How do you answer the how long will I live and how well will I live questions?
I tend to tell patients that if they're starting therapy, and I say, you know, if you're good at taking therapy, you're not missing doses, you're not becoming resistant, and we can get your CD4 count up, that you can expect to live a normal life and die of something other than AIDS. Now, you know, of course, I can't predict somebody's life expectancy, but I can probably tell them that you're not going to die of AIDS. The real question, I think, as I said, is to what degree will HIV-related complications affect your life, even though you're doing well from an HIV standpoint? My own opinion is that if you start early enough at a high CD4, you can probably avoid a lot of those complications. But what I don't know is whether you can avoid them all. I think that's the real hard question right now, the one we need to deal with the most. So, you know, so much of our data come from the practices of earlier years where we did wait a long time to start therapy. And if we started everybody with high CD4 counts, and that's assuming we could find them at those counts and get them into care, perhaps we would see fewer complications. That's my hope as an optimist. But clearly there is some residual inflammation and immune activation going on, even in people who are fully controlled. And so we can't promise people that everything will be just as it would if they were HIV negative.
But I also imagine there's a certain amount of realism that needs to play into that discussion that you have with a patient who may have been recently diagnosed. Because I think, as probably many of the clinicians who are listening to this could attest, a pretty large number of people aren't diagnosed until they already have CD4 counts that are low enough to have brought them into a clinic or a hospital to get tested for something.
That's the thing we got to fix. There's all this talk about test and treat, and let's test everybody and treat everybody. But it was, 4 years ago that the CDC recommended routine testing for the whole population, and we have not come very close to doing that in most parts of the country. In fact, in some states, it's still illegal to follow those recommendations. So we got to do something about this, and it's got to be more on the radar screen of people doing primary care, people doing urgent care, emergency room care. We've got to start testing people before they become immunosuppressed, because so many of these benefits of early therapy are really not even available to such a large percentage of people who are positive just because they don't get tested soon enough. Far more important than the question of when to start is how do we get people diagnosed? And then if we do that, then how do we get them into care? How are we going to expand HIV care and expand payment for HIV care to be able to accommodate the patients that will be coming in as a result of testing?
Are there answers to those questions? There were a couple presentations at CROI that talked about antiretroviral therapy as prevention. And I know that here in the U.S., the federally funded research is examining a test-and-treat style program in both Washington, D.C. and in part of New York City. But on a broad scale, given, I mean, exactly as you said, it's been 4 years since the CDC recommended routine testing for all adults and elder teens, I guess would be the term. But it's still not happening on a very broad scale. How much of that is related to funding? How much of that is related to kinetic energy, just the tendency for things at rest to stay at rest? How much of it is that stigma about HIV is still pretty bad in the United States? I mean, you know, not to mention the rest of the world. It's a lovely idea, and it's great that it's being investigated. But people are still debating whether global warming exists. So how realistic is it?
And evolution and gravity.
Exactly.
Landing on the moon, yeah.
So how realistic is it to spend...
Well, I think that routine testing is realistic. But when I talk to doctors who are friends of mine who aren't in the HIV field, and they'll be telling me about a case, and so I'll say, you know, what's the HIV status? Well, I don't know. I say, well, don't you know about the CDC recommendations 2006? You're supposed to know all your patients' HIV status. I am. It isn't out. They don't know. And unfortunately, maybe we need to have some teeth in this. We need to have some kind of a link to state funding or some really highly well-publicized case of a huge lawsuit against a physician for failing to diagnose HIV would get this into the attention of clinicians. But I think this really could work if we could get... It's partly patient awareness, but I think it's mostly really in the hands of clinicians to be really implementing this in their practices. In emergency rooms, it's tricky because obviously they've got a lot of other stuff going on, and there is some funding, some financial aspect to the testing of in emergency rooms, but certainly in a clinician's office where you're drawing blood anyway, and you're just checking off a bunch of boxes for blood tests, and all you have to do is just tell the patient that I do this kind of testing and I include HIV, and you check off the box, that's not really a funding issue. It's just an issue of having it, being aware of it. I think that you brought up the issue of antiretroviral therapy as prevention. You know, there's this incredible study at CROI in Africa looking at discordant couples, and they found that only one transmission occurred among couples where the positive partner was treated versus 102 transmissions in the couples where partners weren't treated. And that one transmission that occurred in somebody who had just started therapy a few weeks ago. It's an incredibly valuable form of prevention, probably better than anything else we have, including condoms and circumcision and abstinence and everything. It's yet another reason why we have to be finding these patients and getting them into care.
We've talked about the testing part of it, but what you just got to is the treatment part of it. And globally, obviously, there are still issues with treatment access, which would limit this. But you know, even in the United States, I would imagine that for a clinician, I mean, you probably have a lot of patients who are maybe not thrilled with the idea of starting treatment. So you know, what do you tell them about if they maybe aren't psychologically ready to start treatment? What do you tell them to try to convince them that it's a good time to do it?
I talk to them about the guidelines. I talk to them about the evidence that we've been discussing. Talk to them about the issue of prevention. If somebody's got a CD4 above 500, I talk about these things. I don't push it too hard. But as the CD4 gets lower, I get a little more pushy about it. But I think getting people into care is the biggest first step. At least they know they're positive. Hopefully they're not transmitting HIV, and hopefully the fact that they've even come to see me means that they believe in medical care enough to consider therapy when it's really necessary. I think that, you know, that for so many years, people have had this idea that HIV is a disease that you don't treat right away. And so that's in everybody's mind. It's just the thing that they know that. And I think it's going to take a while to change the mindset of people towards an idea that HIV is a disease you treat unless you have a really good reason not to. That's going to take some education on the part of clinicians, on the part of patients, so that they won't be so surprised when they come in and they're diagnosed and you say, let's talk about treatment. But we'll get there. If you have TB, you don't go to a doctor and say, what do you mean I need treatment? You know that you're going to have to be treated. And eventually HIV, I hope, will be seen in the same light.
Let's try to wrap this up then. We have just swept through a lot of different studies covering a broad range of issues that are to varying extents related to antiretroviral therapy. How did the year's premier HIV research meeting stack up compared to previous meetings? And from a clinician standpoint, what are your main takeaway messages from this year's CROI?
That's a good question. For years, I've been going to conferences, and my expectation is that what I'm going to do is I'm going to come back and I'm going to have a bunch of information about randomized controlled clinical trials comparing antiretroviral therapy that will advance the field and help us know better how to treat patients. And that's really been my focus. And it's been how I evaluate a conference. How many randomized controlled trials did I hear? How many new drugs did I hear about? And I think over the last few years, I've had to change that emphasis and realize that a conference can be a good conference even though it doesn't have a whole bunch of randomized controlled trials, that the field has changed and there's other things to learn about. So in that light, I think this was a good meeting, and I think that we heard a lot of interesting stuff about the complications, both of HIV and HIV therapy. I think we heard more supportive data for the idea that HIV is a disease that should be treated, and I think we learned more about the role of antiretroviral therapy as probably the best preventive approach that we have, which is yet another reason to be treating HIV. And we learned, for better or for worse, that we can't necessarily assume that the drug pipeline will just continue to pump out new drugs, and so we have to use the ones that we have very carefully and wisely. I think that the conference helped to support what's going on in the guidelines right now, which was gratifying. So I think it was a pretty good meeting.
Dr. Joel Gallant is a professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and he's one of the top clinician researchers in the United States. Dr. Gallant, thank you very much for taking the time to walk us through the antiretroviral therapy highlights of CROI 2010.
My pleasure, Miles.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice. should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thank you for listening to this report from CROI 2010. For more coverage of this conference, please visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2010.